Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on chemical dependency.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sachin Kale. I'm a palliative physician at Ohio State. This is the third lecture in the series I'm presenting to you about opioids within palliative care. You'll recall the first lecture we talked about the opioid abuse epidemic in the United States and the role of palliative care within that context. The second lecture, we discussed best practices for opioid prescribing. And today we're going to talk, we're going to shift focus a little bit, and what we know is that opioids are very effective for acute pain that's moderate or severe, and that opioids are very effective in advanced cancer. There's also increasing evidence that opioids are not the best treatment for chronic non-malignant pain. And we're going to focus on a little bit of a gray area right now, which is the role of opioids in chronic pain that's cancer-related but occurs in cancer survivors. By the end of this lecture, I hope you can describe the approach to pain assessment in long-term survivors, review treatment modalities for chronic cancer-related pain, review the role of opioids in pain management for cancer survivors, and define indications and implementation of an opioid taper regimen when it's appropriate. So let's first define what cancer survivorship is. So that actual definition varies between different agencies. So the NCCN definition is that a cancer survivorship starts from the time of diagnosis. So the very time someone is diagnosed with cancer, they are already a cancer survivor. For our purposes for this lecture, we're going to use a different definition. So the NCI Office of Cancer Survivorship definition are those who are beyond the acute diagnosis and treatment phase are considered cancer survivors. And then the American Cancer Society definition defines a long-term cancer survivor as someone who is greater than 5 years survival from time of diagnosis. So we'll really be looking at these two definitions when we talk about pain management in cancer survivors. So the prevalence. So over the last three decades in the United States, the prevalence of cancer survivors has increased every decade, every year. As of 2012, there are 14 million cancer survivors in the U.S. Of those 14 million, 65% have been surviving cancer for greater than 5 years, and 40% have been surviving cancer greater than 10 years. And over the next 40 years, it's projected that the number of long-term cancer survivors over the age of 65 will double. So how does cancer survivorship play into our practice in palliative care? So as we all know, palliative care does not equal end-of-life care. And as our field has progressed over time, we've started to see patients earlier in their disease course. And as cancer becomes more and more of a chronic disease, a curable disease, we hope, we'll continue to see patients whose cancers might be cured. This is greatly evidenced in a recent retrospective study. When 28% of patients seen in an academic palliative care clinic had no evidence of disease. And that shouldn't really be surprising. So what we also know is that there is a high symptom burden even in survivorship. So the prevalence of pain is as high as 40%. Now, it really varies. It's anywhere between 5 to 40%. It depends on what the cancer is, what treatments the patient received. We also know that among long-term survivors, 5 to 10% have pain that interferes with functioning and employment. There are many other burdens or symptom burdens that occur with survivorship as well. Particularly depression, anxiety, and fatigue are common symptoms that cancer survivors report. And so palliative care definitely has a very important role in the management and the care of patients who've survived cancer. What we really want to think about today is we're going to focus today on pain management and really think about how does pain management differ in long-term survivors versus those with active or advanced disease. So transition to long-term survivorship affects several aspects of pain management, and in particular, the goals of therapy, the assessment of the pain, and then the therapeutic and treatment options that are available to patients. So goals of therapy. So let's just think about this a little bit. So what is the goal of therapy regarding pain management for someone with active or advanced disease?
Improve function.
Basically to manage pain, right? And to manage the pain that's occurring because of the active cancer or because of the active treatments. So let me ask you another way. What would you imagine, how would the goals of treatment change or the emphasis change in someone who maybe is 10 years out from cancer and comes to you with pain? Would you have the same goals for them as you might have for someone with active cancer? In some ways you will, right? And maybe in many ways you will, but your emphasis will change or should change. So in addition to pain relief, there's an added emphasis on improved functionality, like you mentioned, and limiting adverse events and side effects. So what we're going to emphasize is for and this comes from our chronic pain management literature, where for chronic pain management, the emphasis on pain management is on functionality. What functional outcomes will you get with pain relief? And so we're going to start using that here too when we talk about long-term cancer survivors. Also, we need to start thinking about the long-term side effects of our treatments and what side effects those might have. In a way, we won't necessarily think about in someone with advanced disease. We'll give some examples as we go forward. How would the pain assessment, how might that change with someone with an active or advanced cancer versus a long-term survivor? Well, one question is if it's new or acute pain. So in a long-term cancer survivor, someone who comes in with new pain or acute pain has to trigger a few things. Differential diagnosis should always include disease recurrence, a secondary malignancy, because we know many patients with cancer have at a higher risk for secondary malignancy, either due to their genetics or due to as a side effect from their treatment, right? And then late onset treatment effects. And so this always has to be in our differential. And then chronic pain, patients who present with chronic pain has to be thought of in two ways. One, is this chronic non-malignant pain that might be age-related, maybe due to a non-malignancy, for example, a patient with diabetic neuropathy? Or, if it's related to their cancer, trying to identify a cancer pain syndrome if possible. Identifying a cancer pain syndrome will help you identify what treatment options are available. So let's talk a little bit about the principles of pain treatment in cancer survivors. So it should be tailored based on the pain syndrome if identifiable, and of course also understanding that there may be chronic non-malignant pain in play as well. Adjuvants and opioid-sparing analgesics are often used and should actually be first-line therapy. So this comes from our chronic pain literature as well. We want to try to avoid opioids if at all possible and use adjuvants and other opioid-sparing analgesics. Again, long-term side effects must be considered. And this comes into play with opioids, as we'll talk about, and other medications as well. Certain medications that we might use with someone with active disease, we might not be able to use with someone when we're looking at a cancer survivor. And this is a big take-home point. So when we talk about pain management in cancer survivors, we're really looking at a multimodality and interdisciplinary approach. Here are some common non-opioid analgesics. NSAIDs, Tylenol, adjuvant analgesics, medical cannabis or cannabinoids. And then here's an example of steroids, which are used frequently in pain management, right, with people with active disease or advanced cancer, that we can't use in someone who's a long-term cancer survivor. So steroids are essentially contraindicated for greater than 8 weeks because of the side effects that chronic steroid use has in terms of osteoporosis, in terms of infection risk. So these are medicines, for example, we can't use. But maybe you'll use NSAIDs, for example, in a cancer survivor compared to someone who has active cancer, might be undergoing chemotherapy, might have a low platelet count. In terms of the medical cannabis, so you know, we're still kind of seeing what the role of that's going to be within our field. So currently there's 23 states in D.C. allow for medical marijuana, and the evidence is still kind of coming to see how effective it will be. There definitely is evidence, though, that it, for people with chronic pain, it does provide some degree of pain relief, and that the adverse effects, the side effects, are relatively mild, especially compared to some of the other medications we currently use that have much more severe side effects. So it may very well be a role in the future for using this medication. This isn't to give a kind of a full description of all the cancer pain syndromes, but I wanted to use the next two slides to give you an idea of how you can think about identifying cancer pain syndromes. So these next two tables look at it from a system level. So from a neuro perspective, syndrome examples can be neuropathies or plexopathies. Peripheral neuropathy is common in platinum compounds, taxanes from chemotherapy. A plexopathy, such as a brachial plexopathy, can develop decades after radiation treatment. And so this is when we talked about late onset effects of treatment can happen much later. Myalgias are common with tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors. Painful lymphadenopathy is common in breast cancer, for example, and is associated with a decreased quality of life. Osteoporosis can be a side effect from chronic steroid use, from hormonal therapy. Osteonecrosis, we know, is a risk with long-term bisphosphonate therapy. Pelvic insufficiency fractures can occur in pelvic radiation. These are, again, just examples. This is a great some of this information was taken from a table from this article right here. Also, myofascial pain can occur after radical neck dissection. Adhesive capsulitis, also known as frozen shoulder, can occur after axillary lymph node dissection. Enteritis, proctitis, secondary to radiation. Chronic pelvic pain seen in cancers involving the pelvic bones. Another way to differentiate cancer-related pain syndromes is not by organ system, but also by treatment-related. So chronic pain related to cancer treatment, whether it be post-surgical pain, like amputation, if it's radiation-related pain, if it's hormonal therapy pain, if it's chemotherapy pain, or if it's chronic pain secondary to a stem cell transplant. So that's another way to kind of think about these cancer pain syndromes. And if you've identified a cancer pain syndrome, then you next want to think about an interdisciplinary approach. And this, again, is very much of a hallmark of how you're going to think about pain management in cancer survivors. Patients who are undergoing active disease or advanced illness also benefit from an interdisciplinary approach, always. But realistically, they might not be able to do it. They might not be able to participate as much, either because they're going to several appointments, because they're too fatigued or debilitated to participate, because other contraindications that they can't do it. But in long-term survivors, this is, again, looking at our chronic pain literature. We really want to emphasize this. So this kind of goes in decreasing strength of evidence. So PM&R, physical medicine rehabilitation, these are just examples. PTOT, ultrasound techniques, individualized exercise programs, a pretty good strength of recommendation based on ASCO recommendations. Psychological, cognitive behavioral therapy, chronic guided imagery. Intervention modalities such as nerve blocks, vertebroplasty. There's not as much evidence with integrative massage and acupuncture, and not as much evidence with neurostimulatory such as TENS units, spinal cord stimulation, but it's still definitely something to consider depending on what the pain syndrome is. So now, I'm going to give you a few examples where we match the pain syndrome with potential interventional, or rather interdisciplinary approaches. So for example, a patient with post-radical neck dissection syndrome, mirror therapy, cognitive therapy, you can involve PM&R with mirror therapy, can involve psychiatry with cognitive therapy, And then, you know, as a palliative provider, you can provide neuropathic adjuvant. So that's a good example of where this pain syndrome can involve different specialties. Post-mastectomy or post-thoracotomy pain, intercostal nerve block, using an interventional specialist for that. TENS units, again, the evidence isn't great, but something that can definitely be considered. Lymphedema, PTOT, myofascial pain, trigger point injections, acupuncture, NSAIDs, vertebral compression, vertebroplasty via neurosurgery or orthopedic surgery, weight-bearing therapy with our PT colleagues, muscle relaxants, bisphosphonates, NSAIDs. So multimodality, interdisciplinary, that's the way we approach pain in long-term cancer survivors. So finally, the big question is, what role do opioids have in all of this? So here's what we know. There was a pretty famous review in 2015 that found that insufficient evidence for long-term opioid therapy for improving chronic pain and function. I don't know if you guys have heard about this. This has been in the press a lot. This is kind of one of the basis for this new CDC recommendations. Now, one of the things they found was that most of the studies don't actually look at pain improvement past 6 months. So there just haven't been studies to show that it can be effective. And in the studies that have looked at data past 6 months, there's not great evidence for it. Now, this study was done in patients with chronic non-malignant pain. So not our patient population that we're talking about today, but it's worth thinking about. If necessary, it's been recommended, again, with chronic non-malignant pain, that the lowest appropriate dose should be used for the shortest amount of time. It seems pretty obvious. The CDC guidelines recommend for chronic non-malignant pain not to use more than 90 oral morphine equivalent, oral morphine equivalents per day. That's going to be different for us because we take care of patients right now in palliative who are taking 90 milligrams of morphine at a one time, right, as a PRN dose. But it's worth thinking about. And then adjuvant medication should be used in addition to the opioids. So adjuvant medications are always first line for these conditions for chronic pain. And this is true also. This recommendation is also true for in cancer related pain for long term survivors. So this is true. So adjuvants, opioid sparing analgesics should be first line. Opioids should only be considered if those medications aren't working. If you're going to use opioids. And this lecture is not to suggest that there's not a role for opioids. There certainly is a role for opioids in our population, in long-term survivors. If you're going to use it, though, the NCCN guideline recommendations for survivorship state that the expected outcome should be clearly discussed, agreed upon, both by the patient and family, if family is heavily involved, and documented. It should be specific and objective. It should focus not only on pain relief, but also on functional goals. So we give you treatment. What can you start to do that you can't do now? How is your quality of life going to be improved? And how can we measure that compared to before we start opioid therapy? The duration should be specified. So how long are we going to try this out? And then if it doesn't work, what are we going to do? Discuss how therapy will be discontinued if not working. I think some of these are also very relevant in both advanced cancer and in active cancer as well. But it's particularly important for long-term survivors. And so we need to start thinking also about the adverse effects of opioids. We think about this in the acute setting a lot. With our active, when someone's actively, active cancer, right? We think about constipation, nausea, risk of overdose, and all these things in the kind of acute setting. But there's other things we need to consider when we're looking at long-term chronic use of opioids. For example, about 20% of patients will have endocrine or hypopituitary abnormalities with long-term opioid use. So we're talking about fatigue, infertility, osteoporosis, these kind of symptoms. It's recommended that someone with chronic opioid use be routinely checked, monitored. You don't have to actually get labs for it, but you at least have to ask these questions routinely. There's neurotoxicity associated with opioid use. We know this both with acute pain, but also as we use opioids for longer, patients get older and their organ function just by natural history starts to diminish. We have to be careful that they're not developing new neurotoxicities, such as myoclonus, altered mental status. There is a correlation between use of opioids and risk of falls in the elderly, for example, which is probably not surprising, right? And then sleep disordered breathing. So new onset sleep apnea, worsening of sleep apnea syndromes. There's also some evidence suggesting that increased opioid use can be related to central sleep apnea. So this is something else we need to start to consider as a potential long-term effect of opioids. And then last but not least, possible effects on immune function. This is a question mark. So there has been some suggestions in animal models that there may be effects. Because what we know is that opioid receptors are present in a wide variety of our tissues, and they have pleiotropic effects. We know that opioid receptors have effects on immune function, on cell signal conduction, on the endocrine system, and of course, in how we respond to pain. So there's some thought that potentially long-term opioids might have some effect on our immunity as well. Though it has not been shown in humans, so that's just kind of a speculation. And then there's other adverse effects that we're familiar with and we discussed actually more in our last lecture. So with all opioids, whenever we prescribe this, we also have to be concerned by the risk of from misuse or abuse, the development of an opioid addiction, the occurrence of drug diversion within the community, where we're spreading out more opioids within the community, what's the risk they might get diverted? And then we, of course, need to, therefore, continue our universal precautions approach that we discussed at our last lecture, even when we're talking about long-term survivors. It's important to evaluate the necessity of opioids. And it's important to reevaluate the effectiveness and necessity of opioids on a regular basis, and to continue opioid therapy when appropriate. And so, and again, I want to emphasize that this lecture is not to say that opioids have no role in the pain management with long-term cancer survivors, but that we need to think very carefully about it. And when we deem it appropriate, we do have to counsel patients against opioid. So we need to counsel them that, you know, they're dependent on opioids for pain relief and they're getting good outcomes from it. It doesn't mean they're addicted to it, right? And we also, when needed, and then when a patient has, these are two separate points. So one is counseling against opioid. The other point I wanted to mention is, and this is a separate point, but if a patient is having chronic pain and is getting good relief from their opioids, if their pain worsens or is somehow new, that needs to be reevaluated, right? It's a new or worsened symptom. But what might also happen, though, is that patients may become tolerant to their opioids, and so may be less effective when we think about long-term. And so the recommendation is, if that happens, rather than increasing the dose of the opioid, to try to rotate the opioid, to keep the total oral morphine equivalents the same. So trying not to escalate opioid doses for chronic pain is a recommendation, and try first to rotate. And this is all under continuing opioid therapy when appropriate. So what about when it's not? So if the expected outcome is not achieved, other treatment alternatives should be considered. And if opioids are no longer appropriate, recommend a gradual tapering of opioids to help avoid symptoms of withdrawal. So let's review some reasons to discontinue opioids in this population, and really applies to all populations. So the existence of severe, unmanageable adverse effects is definitely a reason to discontinue an opioid, and it probably discontinued pretty rapidly. Serious non-adherence to the treatment plan, illegal or unsafe behaviors, lack of therapy effectiveness, desire on the part of the patient to discontinue therapy, and a decreased level of pain in stable patients. So a patient, you might have had to give someone a lot of opioids during their active phase of, you know, when they're actively being treated for cancer. But maybe they're stabilized out now, and we can actually start to decrease it a little bit. And that's what we want to think about. These are recommendations are from a 2010 VA Department of Defense clinical practice guideline for the management of opioid therapy for chronic pain. Oh, and then of course if the goals to treatment are not met. So we'll finish off this lecture talking about an opioid taper. Opioid tapering is really hard for palliative physicians. I think it's hard for all physicians. But I think it's particularly hard for us because a lot of what we do, most of what we do still, is actually assessing pain and usually increasing opioids. You know, when people have advanced disease, when they have active treatment, it's rare that we go the other direction right now. But it's something we're going to have to do more often. And certainly in survivors, it's something that's very important. Again, opioids have... there's a risk and benefit ratio, right? There's the risk and benefit ratio. When someone is actively, having cancer or at the end of life, usually the benefits outweigh the risks. When someone has a long-term survivor, 5 years out, 10 years out, 2 years out, when there's no evidence of disease, the risks and burdens of the therapy start to outweigh the benefits. So an opioid taper should be made after discussion with the patient. A good psychosocial and physical evaluation needs to be done, making sure they can handle any withdrawal symptoms they might go through from a cardiac perspective, but also from a mental and social perspective, making sure they can handle it as well. So, if you're worried about it, there's a risk of either suicide risk or the risk of any kind of adverse behavior, to making sure to get more help involved, or maybe having them withdraw in a more monitored setting. Avoid sudden withdrawal in most cases. Now, there's a serious adverse effect from the opioids. You're going to have to do it pretty quickly, obviously. But in most other cases, in the majority of cases, avoid a sudden withdrawal. And maintain, again, this is very important, maintain a clinical relationship through the tapering process and beyond. You're still that patient's healthcare provider. If opioids are no longer appropriate, you're going to work with them to find out what the appropriate treatment is. It's not advisable to send them out with a 6-week taper and say, okay, you're done, you'll need to find another provider now, right? You want to follow them throughout this process, and ideally beyond, to try to figure out what else you can do. The cessation of opioids should not mean the cessation of your relationship with the patient. So, principle of opioid taper is that you want to do a gradual taper to minimize withdrawal side effects. And here are some of the side effects you can see. GI symptoms such as abdominal cramping, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. Musculoskeletal symptoms such as myalgias, arthralgias, muscle spasms. Sympathetic hyperactivity, diaphoresis, tachycardia, mildly elevated blood pressure, dysphoria, rhinorrhea, anorexia, yawning, irritability, piloerection, and salivation. Maybe not salvation, yeah. So, opioid taper principles. So the longer a patient has been on opioids, the slower the taper should be. If someone's been on it we're talking about 3, 4, 5 years, and it's not working for them, there's no reason to try to get them off of it in a month, right? Both from a physical standpoint, but also from a psychological standpoint, right? They've depended on these medicines. In some ways, it helped to save their life when they were going through active treatment. So there's no need to rush it. For the non-addicted patient, a taper by 20 to 50% per week is what's recommended. So in the acute tapering literature, it said that tapering by 20% or less per day should prevent withdrawal symptoms. But the VA, Department of Defense guidelines recommend aiming for about 20 to 50% per week. If appropriate, if there's no contraindications, clonidine, which is a centrally acting alpha agonist, can help to prevent many of the withdrawal symptoms if there's no contraindication. It helps with that kind of flight or fight response that patients can go through when they're withdrawing. So tachycardia, diaphoresis, irritability, some of those side effects can be greatly diminished with the use of clonidine. Now, it won't take care of all the side effects. So it won't help with diarrhea and nausea, and it might not help with the muscle soreness. So you might need to give them other medications to help manage those side effects. So the VA has a few suggestions for different tapers. So for a methadone taper, the suggestion is to decrease the daily dose by 20 to 50% daily until reaching 30 milligrams per day total, and then to decrease by 5 milligrams per day every 3 to 5 days until you get to 10 milligrams of methadone per day, and then to decrease by 2.5 milligrams per day every 3 to 5 days. And you can actually, if you Google this, you'll find it online. Suggested a morphine SR slow release or controlled release taper. Decrease daily dose by 20 to 50% until reaching 45 milligrams per day, then decrease by 15 milligrams per day every 2 to 5 days. And you want to kind of try to, you know, if you're trying to taper someone, they shouldn't be using PRNs, right? You want to have it be a set dose because you're trying to taper. Having them still use their PRNs is kind of defeating the purpose of the taper, because they might just increase their PRN use as you're going down on the long acting. Oxycodone SR, CR, otherwise known as OxyContin, decrease the daily dose by 25%. So you can see, this is kind of all very similar. Until you reach 30 milligrams per day, then decrease by 10 milligrams per day every 2 to 5 days. The VA guidelines recommend against tapering from down on fentanyl, and actually recommend that you switch over to something else before you taper down on fentanyl. You know, they don't give a reason. I think it's fentanyl is tough also because it's such a long-acting medicine, and also even when you take off a fentanyl patch, right, it's still in your system for 12, 24 hours, and you put on a new patch, and pharmacokinetics are strange, a little bit different with fentanyl. I think that's one reason why they recommend not using a fentanyl taper. The other reason is, so they do say that if you are going to use it, once you taper down a 12 microgram patch, which is still, you know, I think 30 oral morphine equivalents, right? So you taper down that, they're still on 30 oral morphine equivalents at that point. So if you're going to use an approach where you taper off fentanyl, then you should be given a brief supply of oral short-acting opioids to complete the taper. And in summary, and I thought I'd give you a kind of a case example I had not too long ago of a patient who was being tapered and saw me, and they were their big side effect from the taper was profound fatigue. So that was interesting. What are some of the potential reasons that they were so fatigued from the taper? What would be in your differential? They could be having increased pain from the taper and not be able to rest. Good. Anything else? So the person on long term, he was on long term opioids, and he was being tapered down, and was complaining about fatigue a lot. Have a clue? What are some of the other side effects of long term opioid use? So we talk about endocrine abnormalities, right? So checking testosterone, checking the endocrine function is really important. If fatigue, especially, this is true throughout the taper, chronic opioid use in general, it's something we want to screen for symptomatically, and it's something, you know, fatigue usually isn't the common symptom of opioid withdrawal, right? We talked about dysphoria, irritability, but fatigue isn't as common, so it's something to think about. So in summary, there are going to be differences in your approach to pain management for someone who's a long-term survivor versus someone who has active disease or advanced disease. And I hope you can appreciate that now after the talk. So there's a difference in the way you assess the pain, whether it's new, whether it's chronic. And there's an added emphasis on the modality approach, interdisciplinary approach, especially with the chronic pain management of cancer survivors. Opioids do have a role in the management of pain, but the appropriateness should be continually addressed, and we need to start being more aware of the long-term side effects of our therapies in survivors. Finally, if indicated, opioids should be tapered thoughtfully and with patient support. very important to maintain that therapeutic relationship so they don't feel like they're being abandoned. And to plan a taper that minimizes withdrawal symptoms. So thank you very much. Happy to take any questions or any thoughts, any experiences taking care of patients in this situation. Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.